Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Hi, this is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, and I'm happy to be joined today on the phone for this radio show by Greg, who has just won an award called Growing Green from the National Resource Defense Council for his work in the field of Florida with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you, Severin. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's pretty hot here, but I don't dare complain. I know it's much hotter where you are.
It is kind of ridiculously hot, and about a month earlier than it should be. We're all kind of a little bit concerned about that, frankly. But it's 96 and getting hotter down here.
I'm sure it's a nice dry heat with a pleasant little wind.
Have you been to Florida lately? No, it's quite humid. It's a pretty oppressive kind of heat down here. It doesn't rain nearly enough. There's always, water in the air. There's always humidity in the air, and so it's a very, even by 9 o'clock in the morning, you feel like you're breathing some kind of thin soup when you go outside. But those are the conditions that people also have to work outside in, and it's pretty difficult.
So many of us have begun to hear about the Immokalee workers based on the work that you have been doing to get the story out. But catch us up. As you look out over the landscape of Immokalee, Florida, what's the predominant land use? What's the predominant agricultural industry? What's going down over there?
Well, Florida is the second largest state in the country for agricultural production on a number of fruits and vegetables. And, for the tomato industry, it's actually the first. It's the largest fresh tomato producer in the United States, and that's the crop that dominates the area around Immokalee, Florida, which is southwest Florida, where we're based. So if you're familiar or your listeners are familiar with the state of Florida, Fort Myers and Naples are on the southwest Gulf Coast. If you drew a sort of isosceles triangle inland, about 40 miles from either of those two cities, you'd land on Immokalee. And, Immokalee itself is a town that really didn't exist about 50 years ago, but as agriculture started to take on this modern large-scale, plantation-scale production that you see today down here, Immokalee came into being because they needed people to work in the fields, and those people needed a place to live, and that's how the city, the town where we live, was born.
And so how did you walk into this scene, this tomato scene? What brought you there?
Me, directly as a person, I came down to work with a thing called Legal Services for Farm Workers, which is a federal program to provide people, poor people generally, but farm workers in my case, with legal representation when they need it. And as you can imagine, farm workers are in need of legal representation a lot. So when I came down, it was the early 90s, but at the same time that I came down, and I had worked previously in Haiti, in the countryside of Haiti, with a movement for development and economic change there. And at the same time that I came to Immokalee, there was the second large arrival of people from Haiti following the overthrow of President Aristide there. And in this case, it was the second wave of people from Haiti, or refugees from Haiti. There were a lot of young people who were involved politically in the movement for democracy in Haiti, and who had these tremendous organizing skills. And they were living in Immokalee by the day, and working, just to find a way to survive, a place to work. But as we started to notice that so many people were around, and I had even saw people that I knew from Haiti all of a sudden there in Immokalee, that presented an opportunity for the kind of organizing that they had done, that we had done previously in Haiti, to be done here. And that was sort of the birth of the CIW.
Well, the organization of farm workers is a marvel, even when they aren't organizing against the conditions which they suffer to give us the cheap prices that we pay. They are organizing themselves with calling cards and wiring money across thousands of miles where they may or may not speak the native language and where there is usually not very good public transportation. Could you just speak a little bit about this kind of marvel of the underground agricultural labor force in this country and what people may not consider really initially, but as a huge logistics triumph?
Right. Well, it's kind of made up of two parts. One is the landscape that they find themselves in, right? And then the second part is the tools they bring to be able to navigate that landscape. And I think, you know, the first part is that where people who come to work in this country, to work in the field, or to find a way to survive and to support their families back home when they come here, what they find is they pretty much have an entry into the very toughest, very worst paid, very least protected, most dangerous, backbreaking jobs that we have in this country. You know, one of the things that the labor market never lies, right? And so the moves of people in the labor market indicate, you know, what is a bad job and what's a better job. So where people move from one job to another shows you which is preferable. And there's really no flow inside the country into tomato picking. It's all out. You know, there's nobody sitting in another job today, daydreaming about the day that they could finally get their bucket and go work picking tomatoes. On the contrary, everybody in tomatoes is daydreaming about the day they can go do something else, whether it's go work in landscaping or in a restaurant or somewhere where there's a roof over their head, you know, and any kind of job but working in the fields. So that's what people find when they first get here. And like you said, it's a logistic marvel to see how people are able to survive. I mean, the best way to understand how difficult this is, just imagine yourself going to somewhere in rural China with an agricultural community with jobs that you've never done before, and that you don't speak the language, and you know you don't know if people are going to be hostile or friendly to you, and you're pretty much alone. You know, and you have to find a way to get by, establish yourself, and then from that established position, support everybody back home who has their hopes and dreams on you. And, you know, for the most part, people find a way to do that. What is the tragedy is when the system doesn't allow people to actually find their footing, you know, and that's when you have people who are having their wages stolen, you know, systematically, or women who are constantly being facing sexual harassment in the fields, which is still fairly endemic, or even in the worst cases, people who are forced to work against their will by employers who hold them and don't allow them to leave or to change jobs and use violence or threats of violence to keep them there. Those situations still exist. The kind of modern day slavery I just described is the extreme, but as Senator Bernie Sanders said, you know, the extreme is slavery, but the norm is a disaster. And so it's you know, trying to navigate those conditions and trying to move ahead in life when that's the current running against you is extremely difficult. And one of the things we're trying to do is to slow that current. You know, through the Fair Food Program, we're trying to change those things so that wage theft is not a regular part of the world as a farm worker, so that sexual harassment is you know, is case by case, complaint by complaint, eliminated until it no longer happens. You know, so the slavery is gone, wiped off the map. You know, that this needs to be, modern day slavery needs to stop. And we're starting to see real results. We're starting to see people's lives changed. So there is, through the food program, through organizing together, farm workers have found a way to move forward as a whole, as opposed to each person trying to find their way by themselves.
Well, and so, of course, the benefits to society of ensuring a fair working environment for those at the very bottom of the socioeconomic ladder and those who are most desperate and willing to work on these kinds of jobs is when we have such terrible conditions, it's a disservice to all of us, and particularly for those of us who are in farming. This is a radio show for young farmers, many of whom understand very much this doggedness that's necessary to survive in agriculture, although not to the extreme of people that you're working with. But, you know, we see directly the impact that these terrible conditions and these slavery wages are having on the price of food and the expectation of cheap food and cheap labor. So it impacts us directly. What have been some of the strategies when you're saying that people are coming into tomato picking and as soon as they possibly can afford to, they are leaving? How are you able to organize with that kind of a community, and what have been some of these strategies you've used?
Well, that's a great question, a very technical sort of organizer's question, and I'll get to that. I wanted to mention, you're right, you know, in terms of benefits, the Fair Food Program doesn't just benefit farm workers. You know, obviously, the primary goal of the Fair Food Program is to help raise wages and humanize working conditions, right? But by doing that, you also help modernize the Florida tomato industry. And the Florida tomato industry is facing real, you know, a battle to the death with foreign production, especially coming from Mexico and from Canada. And price has always been the one weapon used in that battle. Well, in this case, finally, the idea of providing a better product, not just a cheaper product, but a product that's fairer and more sustainable, is in the arsenal of the growers from Florida, and it's giving them a strategy to be able to survive in this increasingly difficult global market. And for the retailers, you know, it's also an advantage, because when they have a product on the shelf that they can say, you know, hey, this is a different tomato. This tomato was picked by people who are treated fairly. And that provides them something new to sell to the customers. And the customers, of course, given the opportunity to understand the conditions behind the food that they buy, they almost invariably choose to support better, fairer produce, more sustainable produce. In fact, there was a poll that just came out, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation released this past week, that showed that 88% of the people polled would say it was $1.50 more per month if that would help raise farm workers' wages by 50% across the board. And 88% of consumers said yes, it would. So it's a benefit for everybody. Now, in terms of strategies for organizing and how you work in a community that is so transient and is not a community really at all in the traditional sense, it's more like a labor reserve. You know, the places in South Africa, the diamond mines, that you have these towns that are made up of almost entirely of young men who have come to find their fortune in the diamond mines, and they live, you know, they live in conditions nobody would accept normally, except that they're in a place where they think that if they deal with these conditions long enough, they might get lucky and might move ahead, right? Well, that's essentially Immokalee and all the farm workers towns that are dotted across the map of Florida. They're places where people don't know each other. They've been there a very short time. They hope to be there even less time. And, you know, it's mainly young men who are not traveling with their families, because it's very difficult to support a family when the other people are not producing an income, right? And you have to pay rent and buy food for everybody, but no one else is producing an income. So it's young men who are transient and hoping to get out. And so that is one of the most challenging environments to organize. And the way we've done it is by emphasizing critical analysis through what's called an approach developed in Latin America called popular education, which is a form of education that's very powerful and it's very useful in communities where literacy is not as high as it is here in the United States. And where people use things like drawing or theater or songs to critically analyze a problem in their lives and try to determine what the roots are. And so in this case, you know, a lot of the problem is, why are we as farm workers so poor? Right? So we'll use theater, we'll use drawing, whatever, and these community meetings, and people will be able, through reflection on the drawing, say, be able to discuss the whys, the roots, behind farm worker poverty. And from there, from that understanding, that consciousness, be able to develop plans of action to try to change it. So for us, our motto, our central organizing motto, has always been consciousness plus commitment equals change. And the whole thing begins with consciousness.
Wow. This is good stuff. No wonder you're winning awards. Now, and no wonder you're making progress in the very belly. I mean, you're choosing the hardest place in the whole food system to work. And then you're getting some serious success. Do you feel like this is the place that you continue to want to work? This is the place that is a right leverage point for these conversations? How do you see the next few years playing out in terms of labor treatment and labor rights and the prices that are paid?
Right. This is a tremendously successful approach that we've been taking. It's taken a long time to get here. Don't get me wrong in that sense. We started back in the early 90s. And, you know, we had to make mistakes first. We had to ask a whole bunch of wrong questions first until we finally found the right questions and the right path. And even then, it's been, 10 years of just unremitting struggle to get ourselves to where we are today, where we have 10 multi-billion dollar food companies that are supporting the Fair Food Program, and the Fair Food Program is being implemented today in over 90% of the tomato farms in Florida. So we are at a place where we can say that what we've done in the past has worked, right? But now we're at the place where we have to be very, very careful to make sure that what we are doing now actually gets established, institutionalized, and works. Right, so we've been having some really exciting results over the first season and a half of implementation of the Fair Food Program and the Fair Food Code of Conduct. Complaints of sexual harassment that have been quickly and effectively investigated and led to quick actions to change, to take harassers out of the scene, out of the picture, and bring more education about sexual harassment to the workers in the field, and where workers themselves have said, this is a great result. That kind of thing has happened over and over again, but it's still very young. And so for us to be sure that what we have done is really going to stick against, decades of history of abuse with no answer, we have a lot of work to do, and that work is just, it's the building of the enforcement mechanism behind the code of conduct. It's the day-to-day education work on the farm, on the clock, that we're doing with workers so that they know their rights and can be their own agents of enforcement, and can use the complaint process to make sure that the bad actors are identified and removed. And when we do that often enough, that it becomes clear to the people who used to take abuse as a given, and that there was no consequence for abuse when it happened in the past. When those people start to believe that doing something wrong will result in their losing business or being fired, then the abuse will stop, and then we might be able to say that what we've done in tomatoes has been a real success.
Now, I don't want to ask too much of the people that you represent, but do you think that there is a possibility that we would see more passageway made for farm workers into the roles of farm owners and operators and leasers of land and eventually perhaps even owners of land and owners of farms in the United States? Is it unfair to ask that of farm workers that they would want that, or is that a viable place to look for more farmers? Is that something we as a nation clearly need?
Well, it's an interesting question, because you had mentioned earlier that that small farmers are facing a lot of the same price pressures that are driving the exploitation of farm workers, right? And that's exactly correct. I mean, when we finally figured out ourselves that it's the consolidation at the top of the food market that is driving this constant downward pressure on prices, and that downward pressure on prices is translated into downward pressure on wages for farm workers. That's when we finally decided that, you know, if we go and we protest in front of Taco Bell in Los Angeles, we'll be able to raise wages and improve conditions in Immokalee. But there's a lot of work to be done, Stan, and we've just, in our tiny corner of the world, we've started to establish this idea that the company that is at the top of the retail market need to actually increase the price. That's that penny more per pound, you know, increase the price they pay so that they can start to undo some of the damage they've done at the bottom of the supply chain, right? That idea, if that idea really takes hold, and if sustainable food starts from a premise of a sustainable price, right? And instead of the changes that are being asked by the retailers or their suppliers to you know, grow more organic or to meet all these standards and or to pay a living wage, and putting all the costs of doing those things on the supplier as opposed to the retailer helping cover some of that cost, then it's still going to be very difficult, whether it's somebody who's been a third-generation farmer here in the country or an immigrant farm worker hoping to farm a small piece of land him or herself, to get ahead. And so if what we really need to do together, you know, and small, and we do, we have a lot of very good coalitions with National Family Farm Coalition and the Family Farm Defenders. You know, we work closely with them on trying to build alliances also between small farmers and farm workers, because really what makes small farm workers poor, or makes small farmers poor, is what makes farm workers poor too. And we're trying to change that altogether. And if that happens, then yeah, I think, you know, farm workers would have a good chance. Because, I mean, farm workers were farmers, most of them, many of them, were farmers back home, you know? And they'd love the chance to be able to use more than just their arms and legs to work, you know?
Well, that's something I'm interested to explore more, is where are the opportunities for entrepreneurship and collaboration, and also a mixing of the roles, where we've seen which people are getting to do which role, and especially since many of us are white kids coming from urban backgrounds and starting our careers as unpaid interns, sometimes mm-hmm. replacing farm laborers who would maybe work harder. In fact, definitely work harder and better than we do, especially in our first years. But most of us are starting out at the very bottom of the labor chain, and we don't walk in at the management level. And so we're very aware, as we then move into more management roles, that we are ourselves, of the work that we are asking from our workers. And I see that as a very positive and democratizing role that apprenticeship plays in training mm-hmm. of new farmers here, but I know very, very clearly that it's, you know, even at the explosive rate that we see new people starting to have interest in agriculture and apprenticeship all over the country growing and beginning farmer programs growing, we just don't have enough. We don't have enough people for all these jobs that are needed, especially when you talk about sustainable and organic production, which of course is more labor intensive. Would you briefly reflect a little bit outside of your state, some of the recent things that I've been reading about in the state of Georgia and Alabama, where in fact there has been a direct response in the labor market to rules that penalize immigrants and farm workers mm-hmm. by allowing discriminatory police, what's it called, profiling?
Right.
And essentially, you know the story better than me, so maybe I'll just let you take over. What happened down there in Alabama and Georgia?
I actually know it very well from personal experience. You know, I for the past 15 years, I've been harvesting watermelons in the summertime. Right, and so for the past 12 years or so, Tifton, Georgia, which is in southeast Georgia, has been my home away from home for 3-4 weeks every summer during the watermelon season. Right, so you know, we go up there and we stay in the sort of watermelon worker hotels that are around town, and we'd go out and we'd work until the season was over. Then we'd move up to Missouri or over to Delaware. And last year we went up there, and our first, we knew that there was going to be a massive difference on the ground when we got there. But our first indication was when we got to the hotel where we've always stayed, there were just a ton of rooms open, and there was hardly anybody staying in the hotel. That was the first thing. Then when we went out that evening to try to find a job, you know, we found a job within an hour. And you know, there was somebody just dying, a crew leader just dying to have somebody who knows how to pack melons and semis, which I know how to do. And so it was very easy to walk into a job. There was nobody staying at the hotel. But the big surprise, or not surprise, but the most obvious sort of measure of the destructive idea, you know, destructive consequences of this idea, was, you know, the next day when we started working, there was this, within a couple hours, there was a pile, a mountain of ruined melons in the packing house, right? Because they had tried to replace the people who usually work in the packing house, people unloading and working on the line, with young people from town, young people from around Tifton. And they didn't know what they were doing, and they were playing all the time, and they were breaking melons right and left. There was this huge waste of melons. It was two or three times a day, you had to haul trucks of wasted melons out of the packing house. And then inside the trailers, the 18-wheelers where we were working, the people who had taken the melons off the conveyor belt and thrown them to us as we were packing, usually that's a job that you train somebody one time at the beginning of the season, and they work with you as the people, the passers of the melons, for the whole season. Well, we couldn't get a pair of people to stay inside the trailers with us, where it's hotter at about 120 degrees inside, for more than one single trailer. So we had to train people every single time we did a trailer. And I came home with bruises on my body that I'd never had before in watermelons, from getting hit with melons when I wasn't ready, when getting hit with melons thrown all over the place. It was like Lord of the Flies or something, you know. The kids had taken over and they had no idea what they're doing, and it was anarchy. And this is an industry that had always been run like clockwork by the immigrant workers who know how to do the job. And the whole problem came from the idea, which has always been a problem here in the South in particular, of the undervaluation of agricultural labor. The assumption that you could just replace people who are professional, skilled workers in a job like watermelons, which is a skilled job. If anybody's ever done it, they know what I'm talking about. If they're not, I can tell you why. But the idea that you could just replace an entire workforce of skilled laborers with just anybody off the street is based on the idea that labor is not actually valuable, when in fact, it's only been paid at a low value, but it is incredibly valuable to the system to get watermelons from the field to the plate. And so you saw this disjuncture between the belief that has always justified paying workers such a low wage and the reality of when you take those workers out of the picture and you try to replace them with people who don't know how to do the job, the food doesn't get to the plate. And there was apparently billions of dollars of melons and peaches and other things left in the field in Georgia last year that didn't get to the plate. And we have a pretty remarkable system for getting food out of our fields to everybody across the country and across the world, and it broke down last year because the people who are paid to do that, who are professional farm workers, were not allowed to do it because of this, you know, wrong-headed and racist idea about immigration. So yeah, I can talk more about it if you want, but that's the answer to your question. You know, it really comes back to this idea that ever since slavery, people have believed that farm labor is not valuable. And it is.
It's valuable, and the proficiency and the muscle memory and the wisdom and the savvy and the stamina of the farm workers that I've worked with and who are working all over right now in this heat is incredible, and a testament to their hope that America would be a place of opportunity. My question that I just keep having is, how can we in the young farmers community express our solidarity, and how might we be allies from the place that we're occupying in the food system to those that you're working with?
Right. Well, you know, the very first thing is just to learn more about it. And, you know, we have a website that is full of information. Some would say over full, but it's got a lot of information all about the history of our organizing. There's a lot of videos that are really informative. There's the basic, you know, the Fair Food Campaign 101, kind of the basic ideas and principles of the Fair Food Campaign. So you can just go to CIW, and that's the initials, CIW, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, -online.org, CIW-online.org, and get all kinds of information and all kinds of ways that you can take action to help us. And then, you know, we agree that the idea is not really supporting what we're doing, but building alliances, becoming allies, because we really are both facing the same pressures. Young farmers who want to get involved and stay involved in the business and make a living in the business, and farm workers who are trying to improve wages and working conditions, we absolutely have the same forces that are keeping us poor and that we need to work together to change. So it's not just a question of supporting the stuff that we're doing, but it's actually getting in contact and building bridges so we can work together to change the system and change those forces to allow people to survive at the bottom of the whole food chain.
I'm in. I'm all in. We can talk about it off the air. So this has been a wonderful interview and a great privilege for me to be able to speak with you. We also are members of the National Family Farm Coalition and Family Farm Defenders. It's a really great privilege to be in a community of farm advocates who care so much and who work in such many different ways to make change happen. Greg Asbett just won the NRDC's Growing Green Award for his work as co-founder of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And they are, again, as I'm sure you got in the beginning, they're based in Immokalee, Florida, and working predominantly with tomato pickers. A really wonderful book to read if you're just tuning into this issue is Tomato Land by Barry Estabrook. So I thank you, Greg, for your time. And
thank
for joining
you so
us.
Much.
And I look forward to the future that you made possible.
No, absolutely. Thank you for the time, too. And let's keep in touch, and same for your listeners.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.